of the morning. Everybody ready? Okay, Dr. Richard Taylor comes to us from the University of Oregon via Canada, New Zealand, and Australia. He comes to speak to us on snowflakes, stress, and semiconductors. Do you see a pattern here? I think it's going to be about fractals. I'll let him tell you about it.
Thank you for inviting me to sunny Vancouver. Although I turned up on Wednesday, it wasn't so sunny when I turned up, but beautiful nonetheless. So I want to talk about the complexity of nature's patterns, with the idea that if we can somehow quantify that complexity, then that can help us learn more about the physical processes that have generated the complexity. And then maybe we can start thinking about predicting these processes, and maybe even controlling and manipulating them. And some of the systems that you can apply the techniques to are quite diverse, as shown by my first slide here. So the image on the left is, of course, your neurons in your brain. The image on the right is a dried out surface of an old potato skin. And it's always worrying to compare the two and see how similar they are. I'm not really a morning person. Certainly when I woke up this morning, my brain definitely felt like an old potato, but it's getting better. So the big question is, why are the two so similar? And of course the answer is that they both are what we call fractal patterns.
Where is it?
Oh, it's over here now. It moved. Okay. So I think I don't need to go too much into fractals. You'll know the basics. They've been around for a long time, since the 1860s, when mathematicians started to work on these exact fractals, where you get an exact repetition at different size scales. Then about 100 years later, in the 60s and 70s, mathematicians such as Benoit Mandelbrot discovered that nature's patterns were also fractal, but of a statistical variety, the way the statistical quantities repeat at different size scales. So for both groups, you've got this repetition at different sizes, and that's what builds up this huge complexity. The question is, how do you actually quantify that complexity? And one of the most primitive methods, and actually because of its primitivity, one of the most successful, is something called the box counting technique, where you take the fractal image that you want to assess, you cover it with a mesh of identical squares or boxes, and then you ask your computer to just identify which of those boxes contain part of the pattern and which don't. And by determining which ones do and which don't and where they are, you can work out their statistical qualities. And then you can repeat that at different size scales by asking the same question for finer scales of boxes. And one of the most crucial parameters in terms of statistics is the coverage of the pattern. How much space does it actually cover? And you can answer that question by simply counting the number of boxes that are occupied, and then keep on doing that count at finer and finer meshes. So for a fractal pattern then, you have a power law relationship between N and L, where N is the number of occupied boxes and L is the size of those individual boxes. So the way that you can confirm fractal behavior is to plot what we call a scaling plot, where you plot log N against log 1 over L, and then because it's a power law, the data will lie on a straight line, and the gradient will be the exponent of the power law. And that exponent is called the fractal dimension. And in a sense, it really is a dimension, in that if you take a one-dimensional line, pass it through the box counting technique, then you will get a d value of 1. If you take a filled square, pass it through the box counting technique, then you'll get a d value of 2. For a fractal pattern, you get an intermediate dimension, because although it's a set of one-dimensional trajectories, because of all the repeating structure you have on top of those trajectories, the trajectories start to occupy space, so the d value lies between 1 and 2. But how do we use this to quantify complexity? Well, let's compare our scaling plots of a low D fractal, might be 1.2, with a high D fractal of, say, 1.7. Along that x-axis, we're essentially zooming in. It's plotting size scales, and we're going from large scales to small size scales. And then on that y-axis, that N is essentially counting how many patterns do we have at that particular size scale. So the data line then is representing the rate at which you pour on patterns as you zoom into finer scales. So the high D pattern, you've got a higher rate, you're just pouring in patterns at much faster size scales, sorry, as you zoom in. So by the time you get to those fine scales with a high D pattern, you just have way more fine structure in there than a coarse pattern. If I show you two simulations of coastlines, you can see that it's two with a D value 1.2 and 1.8. You can see with that 1.8 one, it's just got way more fine structure going into that fractal mix than the equivalent low D one. Now, complexity is often seen as ratios of fine to coarse structure, so in that sense then the high D pattern is way more complex than the low D one. So you can use this D value as a nice way of quantifying the complexity of the system. And there's many ways you can use this, but I'll just briefly show you one example. Not the coastlines of, not physical coastlines, but the coastlines of the Antarctic ice shelves, which of course have been steadily collapsing over the last 20, 30 years. Even if you're not interested in the Antarctic, you should be worried about this. It's going to cause the sea level to rise, and a few small countries at some point will disappear. So if you're interested in drinking Heineken beer, you've got something to worry about. If you're interested in drinking Budweiser, you've got less to worry about, although some people would argue you've got a deeper psychological problem. and you should go and see a psychiatrist straight away. So this is the one ice shelf, the Larsen B ice shelf, from satellite photography in 1986 on the left-hand side, and this is what it looks like today. And you can see that the complexity of the pattern is dropping remarkably during the collapse. And it's a big collapse. This is plotting the area against the year. You can see we're talking about 6,000 square kilometers just on one ice shelf alone. And then this is the D value dropping with it. So what we're hoping to do is develop this into some sort of predictive model where we can actually take satellite photos, and if the D value is starting to drop, then that's a sign of an imminent collapse along the way. So that's just one example, and there's lots of fractal structures out there where you can use D to quantify a changing process. What I want to concentrate for this talk, though, is not structures, but actually processes, because there's lots of processes in nature that are thought to be fractal as well. And this is one famous one. This is actually a trajectory traced out by an albatross as it flies across the Antarctic sky. And in 1996, a group led by Gene Stanley proposed that these were fractal and did an analysis to confirm it. And it's essentially foraging for food. So you can see that in the small areas it's tracing out small trajectories, and it will jump to another area by a slightly longer flight, and then it'll keep on jumping with longer and longer flights and build up this fractal distribution of trajectories. And since then, many foraging animals have had this analysis performed on them and shown that at least it can be understood within this fractal distribution. The reason why it's become really topical is that in the last year, people have started to do it on human beings as well, using your cell phone data, and trying to see if, when you're foraging for whatever, a beer on Friday night or whatever, then you'll trace out a fractal trajectory. Now, from a mathematical point of view, it makes sense why a foraging animal would have a fractal trajectory over just a random one. And it's because the fractal trajectory has all of these longer trajectories mixed into their trajectory distribution. And that produces an enhanced diffusion compared to Brownian random motion. So if you've got a process that wants to cover space very efficiently and very quickly, then a fractal trajectory is really good. In particular, a low D value is really excellent because that has less of the fine structure, which slows the motion up. So obviously the albatross and the people are really quite complicated. You might be thinking, well, can we make use of this? And if we're going to make use of it, we want something way more simple. So let's consider something about as simple as you could possibly get. Let's have a game of billiards or pool, snooker, whatever you want to call it. We all know that game, and it's relatively stable. So if you launch your ball in a slightly different place, then nothing much happens. The evolution of the system doesn't change that much. But if you introduce what's called a Sinai diffuser, which is a circle at the center of the billiard table, then it becomes what's called chaotic. It's not stable. And now you have this extreme sensitivity to initial conditions. So now, if you launch your ball slightly differently, the system will evolve in a completely different way. And what's been known historically about chaotic dynamics is if you actually look at the patterns traced out by the trajectories, they're actually fractal, they repeat at many different size scales. And the easiest way to show that is to actually build a Sinai billet out of mirrors. And this is one that we've done recently, where you've got this cube of mirrors, then you insert a big spherical mirror at the center. Then you can shine these light rays into the billiard and just take a photograph of the rays. And these are some of the amazing sort of pictures that you get out. And I know that I showed this in a talk a couple of months ago at UBC, but in the immediate time between then and now, we just keep on coming out with these amazing pictures. And there's nothing mysterious about it, it's just ray tracing. But you get this amazing complexity for free, which you can chart by simply, is this on?
Yeah.
Keeps on flowing in and out for me. You can just apply the box counting technique to that and get your D value out. One of the amazing things about this simple system is you can just change the geometry in slightly different ways and adjust the D value. So for example, you could just open up the openings a little bit. That will change all of your trajectories of your rays, and you get different D values out. So here's a graph of D against the opening size. So you can very easily, even with this simple system, just tune the D value. And of course, complexity is information. So if you can adjust and control complexity, we live in the information age, and so that's a really useful thing to be able to do. So you could start thinking about doing that in terms of optics, but the systems that we have gravitated towards are electronics. So with electronic devices, most of course are in the diffusive regime, where you have all of these scatters from impurities in the material. But you can make the material so pure to get what's called the ballistic device, where then the electrons can flow through these devices along essentially bullet-like trajectories and just bounce off the walls. And the easiest system is a heterostructure system where you grow, for example, gallium arsenide and aluminium gallium arsenide. At the interface, you get this sheet of electrons, and that forms the plane of your billiard. And then you've got these electrostatic gates on the surface where if you bias those negatively, that forms depletion regions underneath, and that forms the walls of your billiard device. So there we have then quite easily an electronic billiard. Now, there are many ways why you might be interested in this. Of course, ballistic speeds the device up considerably because you haven't got all of the impurities in there. You could also think about making devices, fractal transistors, based on the sensitivity of chaos. But one of the really fascinating things, of course, is that electrons can assume wave-like properties, and so we can start thinking about quantum chaos, which, at least my definition of quantum chaos, is the quantum behavior of a classically chaotic system. Now, one of the amazing things about quantum chaos is, well, I think we know this more generally, is that even if you understand the classical physics, sometimes the quantum behavior can do something quite startling. And the Sinai billiard is no exception. It really does something quite shocking. And so the shock I want to talk to you about is something really quite basic about quantum mechanics, which is the Aronoff-Bohm effect. And basically, the Aronoff-Bohm effect is just dealing and testing quantum interference of electron waves. So in the Aronoff-Bohm effect, you have a stream of electrons coming in from the left-hand side. Then part of that beam gets split into an upper loop, part of the electrons will flow down the lower loop, and then when they meet again, they'll undergo quantum interference. With the Aronoff-Bohm effect, you can show that if you apply a magnetic field perpendicular to that loop, that will actually alter the phase of the electron waves. In particular, the electron waves going in the upper loop, the phase will increase, and the electron waves going in the bottom loop, their phase will actually decrease. So if you sweep the magnetic field then, you'll get an oscillation between constructive and destructive interference. So if you're measuring the conductance through the device, then you'll get this simple oscillation between high and low conductivity. It's fairly easy to show that the period of that magnetic field is inversely proportional to the area of the loop. And this was demonstrated in the 1950s for electrons going through vacuum, and it showed quite clearly that if you have a big loop, you'll have a small period, and vice versa. But with our system, we have the chance to actually build it in an electronic system, because our impurity separation is about 33 microns. If you're happy to go down to millikelvin temperatures, then you can get phase coherence lengths of quite large lengths, about 35 microns. So if you're prepared to build a device of 1 micron, which is quite easy to do, then you should be able to see this Aronoff-Bohm effect. So if you had one simple loop in your billiard, then you should simply get one simple oscillation out. But if you remember back to that optical billiard I was showing you, you're going to have a whole fractal distribution of loops, so you'd expect to get a whole fractal distribution of periods out of this thing. And in fact, you do. And so to confirm the fractal behavior, you can just apply the box counting technique. You take your data, put the box over it, and then count the number of boxes that contain part of the data, and repeat that at finer box sizes. Now, of course, now the box size is measured in B-field space, because that x-axis is in Tesla. So you can get a scaling plot out, where you're plotting now log of 1 over delta B, because delta B is the size of the boxes. And you can see that it follows a straight line for about 2 orders of magnitude. And the way that you find those upper and lower cutoffs, the bounds of the fractal behavior, is you just do a derivative analysis, and it's pretty clear. So doing that sort of analysis, then you get a D value out of about 1.5. So this allows us to put the basic quantum mechanics to test, because in a lot of systems in the real world, the system's really quite complex, and that's what this billiard is. Instead of having one loop, you have a whole distribution of these loops, so we can really see if the Aronoff-Bohm effect and basic quantum interference is doing what it should be doing. So let's just raise the temperature. That will get rid of the phase coherence and should induce a transition towards classical behavior. And that's what we get. So you can see that the complexity of the line is dropping off. It's starting off on the bottom scale with a D value of about 1.5. And you can see it's gradually heading towards a D value of 1. It's just a nice smooth line. Now the big interesting thing is, how does it undergo that transition? What's actually going on? And from a fractal point of view, there's two ways that a fractal system can go from being fractal to non-fractal. One way on the left-hand side, the more exotic one, is that the whole gradient of the scaling plot shifts gradually from 1.5 down to D of 1. On the right-hand side, we have an alternative where the gradient remains constant, but what happens is that your observation range sort of shrinks. In particular, your upper cutoff could shrink until it bumps into the lower cutoff, and then you don't have any fractal behavior. So those are the two, from a philosophical point of view, those are the two ways that it could actually go from fractal to non-fractal. The big question is, what does the Aronoff-Bohm effect have to say about it? Well, remember, with the Aronoff-Bohm effect, 1 over delta B is proportional to the area of the loop. So on our scaling plot, on our x-axis, we're essentially plotting the distributions of loops in the process. So on the left-hand side, we're plotting contributions from small area loops, and on the right-hand side, we're plotting contributions from the large loops. So as you raise your temperature, you would expect that the gradient will stay constant, because that gradient is just assessing the distribution of loops, and that's set by the geometry of your billiard. And raising the temperature isn't changing the shape of your billiard. So you'd expect the gradient to remain constant. But as you raise the temperature, you would expect that upper cutoff to start moving in, because it's going to be the larger loops that start getting knocked out first. They're going to be harder to maintain phase coherence as you warm the thing up. So from the Aronoff-Bohm effect, the simple basic quantum mechanical effect, you'd expect that the gradient would stay constant and the cutoff would actually move down. In fact, so from the Aronoff-Bohm effect, you'd expect that right-hand picture, not the left-hand. When you do the experiment, it's actually the left-hand one that actually emerges. So this is a derivative analysis. As you raise the temperature, going from low temperature to high temperature, it's the gradient, the D value actually shifts, but the cutoff remains absolutely constant. So the Aronoff-Bohm effect says that really shouldn't actually happen. So in this talk, I won't actually go on and explain what is actually happening, because For this talk, what I want to emphasize is that a fractal analysis and quantifying D can tell you absolutely vital information about the physical process that's generating it. In this case, the fact that the Aronoff-Bohm effect is okay in vacuum, but it breaks down in nanoelectronic devices. The other thing that it does with this system, it allows us to identify where the chaos is coming from. Because if we go back a couple of slides, we expected the chaos to be induced by that Sinai diffuser. But actually, when you take the Sinai diffuser out of the device, so you should be removing all the chaos, you still get all the fractals in the conductance. So the chaos and the fractals must be coming from somewhere else. And so we did a whole set of different billiard devices where you change the wall shapes, and that should change the D value, but it doesn't. The D value is independent of the shape of the billiard. We also considered the softness of the walls, that mathematically you expect devices to be what are called hard-walled, but in reality the billiards are shaped by Coulombic effects from the electrostatic gates, and so you've got this sort of nice Coulombic roll-off. So the walls energetically are quite soft. So we decided to actually build billiards of different softness to see if that changed the chaos as well. And so we built this sort of monster device where you have not one billiard in there, but two. You actually have, by this sort of careful layering of the materials, you actually have two planes in there where you define billiards by the same set of electrostatic gates. So that deeper billiard, because it's further away from the gates, will be at a much softer part of the Coulombic roll-off. So you've got a hard billiard and a low and a soft billiard. And yet the softness of the walls, when we actually do the measurements, doesn't affect the conductance fluctuations at all. So whatever's causing the chaos and the fractals has got nothing to do with the walls of the device, which is completely the opposite of what we expected. So presumably the chaos is actually coming from the material itself. And if you go back to a cross-section of the device, if you remember, what we've essentially got is a plane of electrons at the interface between the material, and then we've got electrostatic gates sat on top. But there are a layer of ionized donors slightly higher up. And the reason why they're there is because they've actually supplied the electrons into the plane of the billiard. And the technique called modulation doping, with the idea of this, is you actually put the ionized donors a long way away from the plane of the billiard. And the sort of typical distance is about 60 nanometers, where previously it's been assumed that if you can put these ionized donors 60 nanometers away, that's far enough away that you can forget about them and they don't cause any scattering. But apparently from all of our experiments, it seems to be indicating that 60 nanometers is not enough, that this sort of thing called modulation doping that people have been using for 30 years isn't actually producing ballistic devices. And what's happening is that these little ionized impurities are acting as these little sort of Sinai scatterers. So within a billiard or any device, all that the walls are doing is sending the trajectories repeatedly through this chaotic sea, gradually building up the fractals. So it actually turns out that in terms of electronics then chaos and fractals are going to be way more prevalent than people have previously thought. A lot of devices are going to be chaotic motion rather than Brownian diffusive Drude model type trajectories. So it's going to be important. Let me skip this one. You might be saying, well, how important can it possibly be? Because I've been talking about millikelvin temperatures and all computers work at room temperatures. But temperature is just a matter of the size of the device that you deal with. So for a 1 micron device, we do have to cool down to about 30 Kelvin. But if you're prepared to shrink down to 50 nanometer devices, the operating temperature for quantum mechanics goes way up to room temperature. So if you can build a 50 nanometer device, then you're going to see these fluctuations at room temperature. So that's what we've been doing. We've been collaborating with a group in New Zealand where you actually heat up a material such as bismuth or antimony, and that produces these little 50 nanometer clusters. You then carry them on an inert gas, and then they get deposited on a substrate. One of the pieces of luck is that when they get deposited on the substrate, they don't just form a blob, they actually form these amazing fractal patterns, which we call nanoflowers. Now, the reason why I say this is a piece of luck is that what the previous work has been showing is that probably the electricity will want to creep through the material in a fractal way. So why not build a circuit that's fractal so that it's actually doing what it wants to do? So that's where we're heading. You can see these quite amazing things. They actually seed and grow around points of roughness on the substrate. So what we're doing is using focused ion beam to actually position where these things are going to spread out from. So we can actually start thinking about assembling these electronic circuits, where they grow from one electrode and grow from the other and meet in between. And the other thing we've been working on in the last couple of months is adjusting the D values of the circuits. So if you let the blobs just grow on their own, they have a process called diffusion-limited aggregation, form a very complicated fractal circuit with a D value of about 1.7. But if you grow them such that you allow the clusters to actually migrate on the surface, that smears out all of the fine structure and reduces the D value down to about 1.2. So we can grow these circuits of different D values. I just mentioned very briefly another system where you can put gold nanoparticles on top of DNA strands, and the DNA strands tangle and actually produce a fractal circuit for free. And again, what we're trying to do is work out the growth conditions to tune that D value. And it's very much a sort of fishing exercise. We haven't got anything specific in mind at the moment, but we are doing simulations to see what sort of functionality we can get out of these things. So in the simulations, we're using these simple exact fractals. And one idea is that we're putting side gates on the side of the circuit so that we can bias those and gradually deplete the circuit and knock out the various channels and see what happens to the conductance of the devices. And in the simulations, what we seem to be able to show is that we can transfer the spatial non-linearity of the fractal circuit into non-linearities in the gate operating characteristics. And so what we're trying to do is see if we can adjust the D value and get anything useful out of these things. So you can imagine that when we go to funding agencies, of course what we say is that we're basing our circuits on neurons in the brain. We're expecting less success if we say we're basing it on an old dried out potato skin. I don't think they're going to be that interested in that. But you might be asking, well, why is the brain? Why does it have this fractal dendritic structure? And it has D values about 1.7. And the reason why is that fractals have a huge connectivity because of all of these patterns at different size scales. And in particular, if you ramp up the D value, that increases the amount of fine structure and increases the connectivity. So particularly in terms of functionality, we're showing that if people descend into Alzheimer's disease, their D value of their dendritic structure actually drops off because they're losing connectivity. So you can see why it's important for electronics to have high D values. You might as well go the whole way. You know, if you're going to a funding agency and say, hey, I'm going to build a computer based on the brain, then you might as well go really far out and say, why don't we actually put little chips that we can implant into the brain? Now, the reason why that doesn't sound completely crazy is because people have been implanting things into the human body with remarkable success. And one of the great success stories is retinal implants that people have been working on since 1998. And they're reasonably crude. They're not fractal. They're just a sort of array of photodiodes. But the reason why it's so successful is that no one has actually rejected any of the material yet. Also, they just put this little chip in the back of the eye, and then your ganglions grow on to the photodiodes. The surgeon doesn't have to connect. So the basic message is that if you can supply the hardware to the human body will learn how to interact with it, and then even the brain learns how to deal with the processing. So it's not that big a leap to think that we could actually in the future start inserting these little circuits within the brain or within the retina. And if you're going to do that, you might as well concentrate on something which give it the geometry which it wants, which is the fractal geometry. Now, if we're going to start putting things in the human visual system, then it's a wise idea to start learning about, well, what is the human visual system doing? How does it operate? So some of the experiments that we've been doing is researching the human visual system, both in terms of the eye and the brain itself. And I just want to hit you with a few basic experiments. So one set of experiments are eye tracking trajectories, where you can actually, using a little infrared camera, you can flash an image on a monitor, and then with the infrared camera actually see where the person has actually been looking. And what we've been finding is if you show somebody a very complex image, their eye trajectory is actually fractal. And of course, if you remember back to the albatross, it makes sense why the eye would be fractal, because fractal trajectories have an enhanced diffusion. So particularly with the eye, it really, when it's in what's called search mode, it really wants to cover space really efficiently. And the most efficient way is not a random trajectory, it's a fractal trajectory of a low D value. And that's what we're finding the eye actually has. Regardless of what it's looking at, it has this fractal trajectory of low D. Now, one big question then, if the eye naturally has this fractal trajectory of a low D value, what if you actually show them a fractal image with a low D value? Because then you're showing them an image that they're actually set up to actually see. That's what they're actually dictated to do. There's a whole theory of aesthetics which says that you like something which you find very easy to visually process. So if that's the case, then we should really like fractal patterns of low D values. And in experiments with perception psychologists, that's exactly what we're finding. And we've used up to 1,000 people now in these studies. People really like, from an aesthetic point of view, fractal patterns with low D values. And it's not just a perceptual thing. When you stare at these things, it alters your whole human physiology. So in experiments funded by NASA, we've actually found that when you stare at these low D fractals, it reduces your stress levels by up to 60%. Thinking back to Carl's talk this morning, they've actually got restorative force effects as well. If you stare at a fractal pattern, it increases your concentration, and in effect cleans out your short-term memory, so you're ready to go again. So it's quite remarkable. Now, the other thing is what's actually going on in the brain. And it's fascinating because you get to experiment on little kids, which is completely different from electrons, of course. So what we're finding is there's, in terms of the dynamics of the brain, is there's waves called alpha waves, which are about 3 hertz. And they're known to increase when you reduce your stress levels. And when we show them these magic low D values, the alpha waves shoot up way high. So there's no doubt that they're reducing your stress levels. Now, you can use MRI to see, well, what's actually going on in the brain. And all of your visual information gets dumped in that yellow area initially, called the primary visual area. Then it gets shipped off to these higher areas. And one of these blue areas that was shown here, this is quite an unusual area. It's called the parahippocampal region. And what psychologists have known previously is that these areas get lighted up when you show someone a picture of nature, but they've never understood why. But we're activating it, not showing people pictures of nature, but computer-generated fractals. So we think this region here is actually a fractal detection region. In other words, there's a whole region of your brain actually reserved for looking at these low D fractal patterns. So we're actually built to actually observe these things. So in conclusion, what is it like to be a scientist? Well, you can see I've got a miserable face there, but I'm British and we like to be miserable a lot of the time. But I've got no excuse, because it's a lot of fun being a physicist. And in particular, I hope what you've seen from this talk is that the gap between neuroscience and nanoscience is closing remarkably. And in the future, I don't think neuroscience will belong in psychology at all. I think it will fall into the realm of physics engineering. And I think that at the heart of that, the ability to understand complexity will be like an engine that's going to drive this thing along. So thank you very much for listening to me. So they're about the same size, and we can adjust the density as well if we believe in this sort of seeding arrangement that we can actually choose how many independently of the D value. So we can adjust density of them independently of the D value of the individual ones. So we should. We're very, very close now to being able to build circuits that precisely match, like ganglions in your retina or the actual dendritic structure in your brain. You know, so we can actually build these things. It's a huge step to then start thinking about inserting them out, of course. Although, you know, you can imagine the money there. You know, give me $200 and I'll give you an extra 2 gigabytes for tomorrow morning. You know, it's very attractive sort of thing to be able to do. Yeah.
So when your billiard analysis of the electrons in those devices, on your signal coming out, the period of the signal is related to the area of the path.
That's right.
Inside the billiard device.
Yeah.
So do you get anything useful doing the Fourier analysis of that signal to sort of figure out like how much the paths take?
So it actually turns out that in a sense that scaling plot that I'm talking about is a sort of probing the different size scales and different frequencies. You might say, well, why not use a traditional power spectrum analysis? One of the advantages of the fractal analysis is because you haven't got all of these issues to do with apodization and things like that, and the data you get out is actually a lot less noisy than the equivalent power spectrum analysis. But there are mathematical relationships between the two. So once you've got that analysis out of the box counting, if you want to then talk about the exponents of the power law, you can convert mathematically.
Okay, one more question.
Yeah. And the crystallography, yeah. So yeah, different. It's going to be very, very sensitive to the surface. So the nanoflowers that I showed you there were actually done on graphite, very smooth surface. We are moving on to rougher surfaces. And in the simulations, they're at the moment perfectly smooth surfaces. So essentially what it does is lands on the surface, then the blob will actually roll along the surface until it hits a point of roughness or another nanoflower and start accumulating. But you're right, if you move to different systems where you've got different sort of crystallography, then you can get all sorts of different shapes coming out of these things. And I think that's the power of these self-assembled systems. You can actually manipulate through careful choice of the system. So in the simulations, we actually identify regions where if the thing rolls to it and hits, it will actually stay. And then the next one, when it hits, it will actually stick onto that thing.
Okay,
thank you.
Okay, our final speaker of this morning's plenary session is Jordan Rose. Hello. And he got his PhD here from the University of British Columbia, and he went on to he's the founder and the chief technology officer of Z-Wave, the company that is pioneering the development of a new class of high-performance computing systems using adiabatic quantum computing. Let's thank our speaker.
Thanks.
Yes, perfect. I'm just grabbing this microphone. Is this the right one? Yeah. Is the right one?
Can everyone hear me? I'd like to just follow on from the previous speaker. He made a very interesting point at the end that you should pay a lot of attention to, and that's that neuroscience, you know, study of the brain, has historically been about biology, and, you know, cutting up brains and looking at how they work. But there's a trend recently that's very interesting, is that other fields of study are starting to learn a lot from the biology of the brain. And the one that I'm particularly interested in is in building computing systems that do things that the brain is very good at. And I'd like to point out two things. One is that the best known facial recognition software is biologically inspired. So there's a competition every year where all different types of software systems that are supposed to be able to distinguish a particular person compete against each other. And the one that's won the last 2 years was developed by a guy I work with at Google. And it's inspired specifically by the structure of the way that your optical system and the connections into your brain work. Another thing I'd like to mention that is very interesting if you're a physicist is that many of the leading candidates for developing truly intelligent machines share a lot in common with statistical physics, and in particular studies of Ising models. So you can think of a bunch of neurons as being kind of plus one, minus one variables in some sense. And the learning process can be mapped into something that's very much like thermalization of a bunch of these things that are connected together. And in fact, that's the way that a lot of modern machine learning works. So if you're a physicist and you're interested in learning intelligence and all that sort of thing, you have a real step up on the competition, and you should really think about neuroscience, because from my perspective, it's been a very fascinating thing to learn about all this stuff.
Okay, but that's not what I'm talking about today. So what I'm going to talk about is how to structure a big science project. So this is not the title that's in the book that you've got, because I thought that was a little bit too restrictive. So what I'm going to do is try to give you my perspective on how you take something that's a basic science, it's the status of a basic science project, which is really, really, really an ambitious thing. It doesn't have to be quantum computation, it can be anything. How would you actually go about building one? So in the previous example of building intelligent machines, okay, we kind of understand what that means qualitatively. And if you were to think, if we were to go forward in time 200, 300 years, and you were to ask yourself, well, what's the chance that we'd actually been able to do it? I think very few people would say that there's zero chance. And I think most people know something about the development of technology would say it's inevitable. It's going to happen at some point. So if you're a historian 300 years from now and you're looking back at the development of something that we don't have now, like quantum computers or intelligent machines, what would it look like? What's the most likely scenario for the development of something like that? And I think that doing this is an important exercise because it can point out things that appear intuitively to be right that if you think about them in any detail become clearly wrong. So what I'm going to do is share my opinion on ideas about large-scale science and how they develop into technologies, and specifically I'm going to talk about quantum computation because it's the thing I know most about. So how many of you in the audience either study or are familiar with quantum computation? Okay, so it's a pretty small number. Of those folks, how many of you think that we'll never be able to build one? Okay, so that's not an unsizable percentage. So this slide here I thought was really funny when I first saw it. But it points out something that's going to be a theme that runs through this talk. Development of new things in large bureaucracies is very, very hard. So I was just laughing when I was reading some of this. It's like, we're planning to bring a wireless modem into the, and this was like a 10-year plan. And if you think that this doesn't actually happen in reality, you're wrong. So we've had experiences dealing with universities where we wanted a lock. I'm not going to mention which university. I'm standing in it. Where we wanted to have a lock changed on a door. It took 6 months. They wouldn't let us do it ourselves because there's a deal that they have with the people who change locks in the university, and we weren't allowed to just go in and take the lock out. Would it have taken 30 minutes? No. We had to wait 6 months. And that is endemic to large organizations. And things that take 6 months that should take 10 minutes kill ambitious projects. It's just a total non-starter. So this is sort of a theme that's going to run through this. Just a little bit about me. So D-Wave isn't the only thing I've been involved in, although it's certainly consumed a lot of my life over the last 10 years. There's two other things that I do. Most of what I do is raise money and architect projects. So this is kind of what I do as a full-time job. I was a grad student here less than 10 years ago. So we've bought an awful lot of money and people into the local economy. And another theme that's going to run through this is that anybody can do what we're doing. And one of the outcomes of this is I'd like the people who are thinking about grand things but think they can't do them, you got to put that aside because it's not true. If you want to do something really, really big, people will cluster around you and follow you because people like being involved in big things. You know, even if they say, oh, it's too hard or whatever. People will put that aside if you can inspire them to try to do things that are beyond the pale. Just one slide on D-Wave. So we're more or less focused on building infrastructure that can support the development of quantum computation, in particular superconducting versions. So we build and operate tools and assets that aren't available anywhere else. So as an example, we have the first and only production foundry for superconducting electronics. So production foundry is one that's to the standards of the semiconductor industry. So we can build things for anybody who wants them that are unique in terms of line widths and yields and things like that. We're very heavily research-oriented, and about half our staff have PhDs. Okay. So this talk is going to be about quantum computation, but remember, I'm sort of talking in more generic terms about big science. So when you begin a basic science exercise like this, so you're going to think about how to build something, think quantum computation for first example. The people who exist in the infrastructure, in the community out there, who you're ultimately going to be competing against with your thing, are way better than you at everything. So you may think, because you're a world-leading scientist in some particular area, that you have some special thing that no one has, and you're probably right, but that special thing is only a very small part of a big puzzle. And in terms of computation, if you're going to build a computing thing that isn't silicon, you have an awful long road ahead of you. Because the people who are out there who are building the things that are in these laptops have had a lot of time and a lot of money and a big, huge head start, and they're very, very good, trust me. And people I've met in the semiconductor and software industries are exceptional people. So that's the first thing I'm going to talk about. The second is, when you're thinking about developing big science, there are lots of case studies of both successes and failures. So do they have any common features? And then the third thing is, I'm going to conclude with why my own personal view about this, you know, why quantum computers I think will be built. So I'm going to argue against the three people who put up their hands and said that it wouldn't happen. Okay, so in the computing industry, if you're going to build a quantum computer, you have to deal with a very important fact. And that's that the things that people build today are absolute marvels of technology. If you stop and think a moment about the things that we do and take for granted now, they're unbelievable, and they would have been unbelievable even 30 years ago. So cell phones, you know, you can talk to anybody in the world. They cost like $100. You can go into, I was in Best Buy the other day, and you can buy a machine with like a quad core latest version processor for $500. I mean, just thinking about what that means in terms of the computing power that you have easy access to, that machine that costs $500 has more computing capability than the sum total of every computer that was on the planet 30 years ago. So the progress that's been made is immense. Another thing that's very important if you're going to build a new thing is that the way that computation has developed, the foundries that build the chips and the designers that are asking the foundries for particular features have been built in lockstep and very highly optimized to each other. So it's not simple to go in and ask for some strange process. So if you want to build something that's not what TSMC or one of these big fabs delivers, if you do not fall within the design rules that they give you, you're in big trouble. Because even if you're just a little bit off, what you're going to have to do is build it yourself. And just think about the difference between a fab that is the product of $1 trillion of investment, and that particular building and the tools in it cost $10-15 billion to build, and your thing that is in your lab, run by your graduate students. Now, that's not to say that those things can't do good work. Of course they can. I mean, they're the basis of all basic research in science. But if you're going to build a thing that works repeatedly, you're in big trouble if you're going to try to compete with that. And anybody who's trying to build a quantum computer is in that category, because you can't build a quantum computer using TSMC fab, as far as I know. I mean, if you could, that would be great, but I certainly don't know how to do it. There's a truism in the investment community that if An entrepreneur, someone with an idea, comes to an investor and says, hey, I'm going to build this great chip. Oh, and by the way, it's built out of gallium arsenide. They're like, no, forget it. You cannot build a product, anything that people will use, unless you use TSMC or one of its cousins. So this is not really a scientific way of looking at the problem, because why do you say that? I mean, maybe I could, but they won't even look at it. So if you have something like quantum computer, which is not only a non-standard foundry thing, but you can't, it's very difficult to explain even what it is, you're in big trouble. So one of the ways that people approach this situation, and in fact the majority of people do, especially ones who are not scientists, is to say, what is this quantum computing business? You've just told me you need to do something different, fab, we can't explain to me what the thing is good for, I don't understand it. Is that enough to say, no, let's not build quantum computers, because it's just a ridiculous thing to even start. So what I'd like to do is think about other things that are related and see whether or not the things that seem to be so daunting in this field really are roadblocks that you can't overcome. It turns out that there are lots of big projects that have at least the same complexity and difficulty that people have undertaken in the past. Many of them have succeeded, so the ones in the left-hand column I consider successes, and many of them have not succeeded, and I put those in the right-hand column. Now some of you may question why some of them that are in the right-hand column or left-hand column are there. But I've picked out four, and I'm going to go over them and why I think that there are these. So the first one I'm going to talk about is a very fascinating thing for people who study the history of computation, is Thinking Machines. So Thinking Machines is a very innovative company that was developed based on a very interesting idea, which is in some ways biologically inspired. So the basic idea for the machine was lots and lots and lots and lots of little processors connected up in a smart way. So the objective of this exercise was actually quite grand. The people who started it wanted to build thinking machines. They wanted to build things that acted like humans, or behaved like humans, or somehow mimicked the processes behind the way that humans reason. So in the middle of April, a first box, and many of you who are geeks will know what I mean by this box, it was the black thing with all the red lights flashing on and off, was released, and people who used it loved it. About 5 years later, there was an entirely redesigned version that was designed not for AI problems, but for general scientific computing, like it could run Fortran. And then 3 years later, the company was gone. So how did this happen? A couple lessons. One is that they built something that they thought was fun, but no one really wanted. They built a machine that was really expensive, and $5 million in those days was quite expensive. And the people who they were building it for couldn't afford to buy it, so governments had to buy it. And this is a quote from one of their competitors at the time. And for quantum computing people, this is a really important point, is that it's not enough to try to build something that you think is fun. It's not enough to focus on building things that satisfy your innate curiosity. As a builder of things that have value, what you're doing is you're building something for someone else. And if that someone else is not able to pay you for it, you've failed before you've even started. So the analysis that I would put on this particular example is that they became overly dependent on the government. And that's why they failed. Second one I'm going to talk about is a little bit more contentious, because some would claim that this is not a failure, although I will argue it is, and I'll just tell you why, is ITER. So there's no doubt in anyone's mind that energy and the cheap available clean energy is probably the number one issue on anyone's list of global problems. It would be very difficult to argue otherwise. So building a machine that can generate cheap, clean energy is probably number one on the list of anybody's most useful ways to spend your time. So I don't have any problem with large-scale projects to generate energy. I think that they're great. Another thing is that there's clear evidence that this approach that's being followed is going to work technologically. there is a trend that's been followed over many years of increasing the number that you need to get sustainable fusion. And it's predictable, and you pour a certain amount of money in and you get a certain answer out, and I have no doubt that this will continue into the future. The problem, though, is that the project has been architected to only give results at a long time in the future for an enormous amount of money. So this type of approach is telling you that even though the technology may work, it costs too much and it takes too long. So I'm going to blame this on something that is something that can happen to big science projects, which is inertia. If you get the majority of the people working in a field to back a certain viewpoint, it's extremely hard to change that viewpoint. If you think about any large equipment project that might be relevant for your field, once it gets going, it's really hard to stop. And if it turns out that it was a bad idea, it's really hard to admit that, especially if you were the one who was leading the charge at the beginning. So the big science can go wrong when the dominant ideas crush competing ideas. So in fusion, you have two big types of projects. You have inertial confinement and you have the tokamaks. Anybody who doesn't work on one of those two things gets a tiny little bit of funding and they don't get listened to a lot. And that's not a good environment for developing competing ideas. And the relevance to quantum computing here is that there are ideas that are dominant ones in quantum computation that may or may not be true, that shuttle resources into particular directions. And it could be that if you were to pick a wrong path, let's say we were to pick the path that we're taking and it turns out to be wrong and all the resources were shuttled into that particular path, it can kill all of the other ideas that might actually work. So that's true for any particular idea. I think you always need to have multiple competing approaches. The other point here, of course, is that the fusion guys have run into this problem that it's become about the means and not the end. It's become about building a tokamak and not about producing energy. And that's not something that you can afford to do if you really want to achieve the end, which is producing energy. So my first success story is, again, one where you might wonder about whether this should be called a success, but it's the development of nuclear weapons, in particular the atomic bomb. So, you all know the story. Many of you have probably read the big, thick, red book about the history of the development of this. It's a fascinating story about the sociology of basic science and how it interacts with government agencies and engineers. And if you haven't read that big, thick, red book, I forget who the author was, but you should find it and read it. Most big science projects that people can think about are actually quite easy compared to this project. Looking back on what they had to do to make that work, there were all sorts of things that they had to overcome, basic technology issues in entirely new fields for which there was no precedent, there were no experts, there was no one knew how to do or even how to approach five or six different aspects of this, and they all had to work together. So the coordination involved in deploying all of this new stuff was amazing, and it dwarfs the complexity of the project that we're working on, for example. So what were the characteristics of this that made it work? And there's been a lot of academic work and sort of post-analysis of the things that made this go, because it's been used as a model for several things that have been followed it. And everyone basically distills it down into these components. So the first thing is, if you're going to do something ambitious, it's not enough to have a vague idea about what you want to do. That will kill whatever you want to do. So if you want to build a quantum computer, you can't say, well, I'm going to try this qubit and I'm going to do this and that, and maybe something will, no. You have to make a very specific argument about what you want to be able to achieve. So for these guys, there was a threshold for the yield of the bomb over which they had to pass, or it was a failure. That was what they did. The second thing is that you have to make failure hurt. So often in the environments in which basic science is done, failure does not hurt you. So what I mean by that is you do not lose your job. You don't lose your livelihood. All is not lost if you don't accomplish the objective that you've set out for yourself. In this case, there was a propaganda and maybe the reality that you would lose your freedom, maybe lose your life to another army that was considered and probably was in some respects evil with a capital E. So these guys were under a lot of pressure to produce this thing. Third thing is that you need to have a lot of different types of people working on this thing together under one roof. So often in academia, there's a collaborative model that arises out of necessity where you have many universities working on things at different places. And those of you who've tried this know that it's quite difficult to make everybody work together because you get just basically it's like herding cats. You know, there's very, very hard to make the pieces fit together. If you're going to do something like this seriously, you need to have everyone under one roof. In my view, that's not a negotiable thing. You absolutely need to have people have lunch together if you're going to pull something big off. You need to have good management. I won't go into length on that. If you have all these other things, that will come. And you need to have a schedule-driven, strong leadership. So you need to have somebody who's responsible for all this, whose head will roll if things don't get done. The second one, which is a lot more interesting to me because there are a lot of parallels with D-Wave, is Celera and the sequencing of the human genome. So there, again, there's a lot of being written about this particular example. Celera took on the establishment. So there was a very big project, biggest project that was being financed by the US government since the Apollo project, multiple billions of dollars a decade. And it involved basically everybody who was working on sequencing the human genome in the US. A big, big group of very well-respected people. And this guy basically came out of nowhere and said, we're going to do it in a tenth the time for a tenth the money. And that was taken as a direct affront to the establishment. Now, what Venter realized at the time was that all of the things that I've just been talking about the way that that big science is organized, made it so that the public effort was going to work. It would take 10 years, but why not try to do it faster? And he thought he found a way to do it faster. And he put his money where his mouth was, and he raised it, and he started what, at the beginning of this, was a very rocky road. So Venter, when he announced that he was going to beat all of these other guys, got plastered in the media in places where it was probably not a good idea to say these things in print because you can't take them back once you say them, such as Science Magazine and the Senate, US Senate. But respected scientists went on record saying, you know, he was an asshole and a monkey and a fraud. And but in the end, he was vindicated, and there are still people to this day who criticize the approach, the science, and all of that. But you know, trying to look at it with an unbiased perspective, I think it's mostly sour grapes. So if you go to some of the literature that's still published by many of the leading institutes that was in the government side of this, they still refute some basic aspects of what they did. But how do you measure success? So if you're in a business, you can measure the market cap. It's pretty big. He did have two very famous papers, many more than that actually, but I'll just pull these two out. One is that he got credit for the first sequencing of the human genome, and another first, which is the sequencing of an individual's genome, which was his, which was like a big screw you to all his critics, I think. Yeah, my genome. Anyway. So if you look back and say, how did this happen? It actually shares a lot with the Manhattan Project at a high level. They knew exactly what they wanted to do. They had a stake in the ground, which was basically that if they did not pull it off, all those guys who called him a monkey and an asshole would be right. So if he failed, you know, he wouldn't be sailing around the world creating artificial life or whatever the hell he's doing right now. He'd be, you know, eating out of garbage cans and working at McDonald's. Like, literally.
because his reputation would have been so tarnished that he would not have been able to get a job in the field in which he loved to work. So I think that there was such a motivation for them to succeed, and that ended up being a part of why they pulled it off. And they had all of the other things, too, that are required. So I believe that that if you want to predict the success of something, or looking at it another way, if you're going to pretend that you're a historian looking back on the history of some big science project, what you will see in retrospect for all of the ones that succeed are these four things. You're going to see that the people involved had a very clear idea of what they wanted to do, and they put their neck, they stuck their neck out and said, I'm going to build an intelligent machine. And if you guys think that I'm wrong, then go screw yourself. So they're going to put themselves out there and they say, I'm going to do something very ambitious. The second thing is that you can't do this if it's okay to fail. Because if it's okay to fail, when you have to stay up for, you know, 24 hours in a row because you have a deadline that you have to meet on Friday or else the business will go, you'll go out of business, you won't do those things. So you need to have desperation. Another thing that I've just briefly touched upon, but it's an important point, is that getting all of the best minds together under one roof is not the right approach always. You need to have people who are complementary, who work well together. Many people who are the leaders in their field are very difficult to work with. If you have one or two people who will refuse to work with others, it kills a project. So you have to be very careful when you're building a team that everybody is kind of gelled. You know, do you go out to lunch with these people or can you not stand them? If you can't stand them, you're not going to pull it off. You need to have the people, hey, I want to go to lunch because I want to talk to him about whatever because, you know, we share interests and all that stuff and we're good friends. So you need to have a team where that's kind of a constant factor. And you need to have people leading it who can communicate the message. So just briefly about quantum computers. So quantum computers are in this weird place now where there's a lot of theory, but there's not a lot of practice. So one of the things that they may be good at is simulating other quantum systems. And often people say, well, what is it worth to build a quantum computer? And the real answer is no one has the faintest idea. So you can try to quantify these things, and I've done this for several different markets, but when it comes right down to it, no one knows. But it's probably pretty big. And just to give you an idea about this particular quantum simulation thing, it's pretty clear that if you can simulate quantum systems at the level that you could with one of these machines, a large-scale machine, you're going to affect the R&D that goes on within them. And these three industries that I've highlighted, which are the pharmaceutical, chemical, and biotechnology industries, are fairly large. So just to give you an idea about how large, if you sum all of the market caps of these three industries in the U.S., the market caps are larger than Canada's yearly GDP. So that doesn't really mean anything. It's just a number. But it gives you an idea about how much people value the output of those particular industries. And I think that quantum computers will fundamentally affect them. Now, how much are they worth? I have no idea. Another thing about this particular field is that everybody, except for the three people in the room over there, believe that these will eventually work. So I think that, you know, there's still some question. Of course, if you haven't actually done something, then there's a big question as to how it will work. But I think that the ecosystem for computing right now is ready for this. And if you look at the way that high-performance computers are architected nowadays, the idea of using accelerators as some component of a system is on the rise. So I'm just going to skip through to the end here. So when you have a large-scale science project, looking back on it, I think that the four things that you're going to find are specs, probably a startup, because startups have that desperation component and that is hard to find anywhere else. Another thing is that if you're going to build a computer, you're not going to do it with a bunch of scientists coming from the quantum computing community. It's going to be built from engineers that come from the incumbents. This relates back to this point I was making about how the incumbents were so good at building computers. If you want to build a quantum computer, you're going to do it with them, because they're way better than the scientists who work in this field at building computers. You need the scientists, of course, because those other guys don't know what the hell they're doing when it comes to physics and some of the more fundamental aspects of quantum computation. If you're actually going to build something that works, they need to be them. Just one last thing I'm going to leave you with is that many people in academia, or maybe all, are funded with public money. And I've found sometimes that that is actually a double-edged sword. So grants have this weird structure where you're paid money to do something and then it's kind of over. And you tend to be motivated to supply a story to the granting agencies that they want to hear. So Richard was saying this earlier, and it's true. The funding agencies want to hear a story. So what you do is you take what you think you want to do and you box it up to make it like what they want. But why? I mean, think about that for a minute. Most program managers in government funding agencies, first of all, they're not experts. Second of all, some of them don't even understand what they're funding. And you should be telling them, but that's not the way it works. So I have a feeling that some of the process of getting grant money from governments leads people down the wrong paths. So I prefer to not have to deal with that. So if I'm going to fund something, I want to raise private money. Because private money, you can go and say, I want to do this weird shit that no one else is going to try, and here's why I think it's a good idea. Whereas that doesn't always fly with the public funding agencies. And the private guys are more willing to accept risk than the government ones, paradoxically. So I think that the quantum computing side of things anyway, the ecosystem's ripe for it. I think it's ready to absorb a product like this. And it's going to be built by the people who come from the incumbent industries primarily. It's not going to be built from the basic science side. And I think that a lot of basic science projects eventually are like this, that the ideas originate in the community, but then when they're actually built into real working things, they're taken away from that community and put into the incumbents who then alter what they do to produce that new thing. Okay, thanks. Well, the objective, of course, is to make them all true. So whether or not we've succeeded or is I guess, open to debate. The thing I think that is the weakest one for us is specificity of purpose. So we know kind of what we want to build, but there are enough questions as to what it will be used for that I don't think it's been properly answered. So you can build hardware, but that's not what people buy. People buy the hardware doing something, and we haven't solved that problem yet as to what it will be doing. We want to be able to build a computing system that can solve problems that you can't with any other computing system.
You haven't answered the second part of the question. When do you want to achieve that?
Within 5 years. And it's not what we want. It's a constraint that's forced on us by financial reality. We can't continue to fund this thing without achieving that kind of milestone.
So is that a live or die situation?
It is. Startups are all like that. It's not just us. Any startup that's venture financed, you have a fuse. If you don't achieve what you say you're going to achieve within a certain period of time, you die. Quantum simulation. Initially, yeah. So the simulation, for example, of small molecules interacting with receptor structures on the outside of cells, that would be a big one. But there's another one that's receiving a lot of attention now, which is the simulation of the process where photons hit plants. Because apparently there's a growing belief that the receptors in plants that convert sunlight into electricity, there's something fundamentally quantum mechanical going on there. And it could be that simulating that sort of thing at the level that you could with one of these machines would open up all sorts of new ideas for solar cells that are more biologically inspired.
Any other questions? Okay, let's thank our speaker.